the gall of this guy.
Brain soda.
It's the Brain Soda Podcast. I, as always, am your host, Kyle, joined by my co-host and cohort, Brad.
How's it going?
Today, we're going to be talking about phrenology. But first, Brad.
Yes, Kyle.
I want to take you back in time, Brad. I don't know about taking you back to memory lane, but we're going to go back in time for today's subject, okay?
Okay.
We're actually going to go back in time twice.
All right. Do we have like a time machine? Are we doing like, do we have like a way back machine or something like that?
No, we have a podcast. It's the closest I could do. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Times are tough. But
yeah, I'm sure it's not cheap for one of those. Yeah.
We're going to start really, really fast in one point in time. And then we're going to double back closer to what you and I would know. Are you ready?
Ready.
So in 1690 or... 1692, okay. William Shakespeare developed one of his most controversial works in The Taming of the
Shrew. All right.
We, amongst maybe a few other adaptations, would know this primarily for one film. Can you tell me what that is, Brad?
Titanic.
No, today we're going to be talking about 10 Things I Hate About You.
Oh, man. This is one of my favorite... Like 90s, was it 90s? 90s, 2000s?
Late 90s, yes, you're absolutely right.
Comedies, like it is great, yes. All right.
Absolutely, you hit the nail on the head. This is a late 90s, early 2000s teen comedy. More exact to be more of a like romantic comedy. And I'm going to say right now that not only is this our suggestion of the week for couples, most specifically.
Sure.
I feel like this is a great date movie. But I feel like also this is good for our younger female listeners, our female listeners overall. And
yeah, I mean, it's for all sexes and genders. And man, because like, I mean, maybe I'm just a sap.
So released on March 31st of 1999, it is a modern take of Taming of the Shrew.
I never knew that, man. That's so cool. Like, I love how like, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but like. Freaking media sure as hell does, that's for sure.
Well, revisiting people's works too, and we are going to get into that because I feel like there's a specific reason as to why this adaptation happens when it does. But regardless of such, this film has a budget of $13 million. How much do you think it's grossed, Brad?
I'm terrible with this always, but I'm going to say $150.
Lower.
Okay, I usually undershoot. All right.
Much lower.
25.
A bit higher.
30.
$60 million. And it,
okay.
And yeah, it's a pretty good showing. And critically, it was pretty well received. It won a lot of like MTV and Teen Choice Awards, you know, of its era, right? But it kind of developed the cult status as well. And a large part of that is because it helped launch the careers of Julia Stiles, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and Heath Ledger.
Really?
Right?
They launched theirs? Okay, yeah.
Yeah. It also featured another actress who we would know as she was on The Secret Life of Alex Mack on Nickelodeon. Do you remember that show?
Yeah, I remember. I don't think I watched much of it.
The girl who could turn up protoplasm and
Yeah.
So we kind of knew her already from that, like 94 or whatever, right? So Joseph Gordon-Levitt's best friend in the film is played by David Krumholtz. Most people would probably know him from Numbers.
The show Numbers?
Yes.
Okay, I've always wanted to watch that.
I've always heard good things as well. He was also in the Harold and Kumar movies, the Santa Claus movies. David Krumholtz is a very celebrated actor. I enjoy everything I've ever seen him in. But, like, I really low-key forgot he was in this movie. And I love, one of his big lines of, there's a on my face, right?
Oh, okay.
Yep. But with that, it's funny to see how they set this teenage rom-com in the late 90s in Seattle, Washington. And not only is that, like, I feel a kind of stereotype of films of the era, right? The soundtrack that it chooses and things like that. Because, like, the film opens up with bare naked ladies and all this other stuff, right? It's super stereotyped. But, like, even the characters. Like, you open up in this guidance counselor's office. And while she's sitting there guiding children, I guess, right? She's writing her like romance novel, like her erotic romance novel, because it is kind of dirty, the things she's writing about. And like, that's kind of her character motif. And when you look at some of the other kids that like, we don't have any roles to play in the story that goes off through this narrative, everybody's like this super stereotyped depiction of a clique in high school, right? And like, that's kind of par for the course for the time, but I really feel like it helps this story in particular, because like when we talk about Kat, right, you know, one of the main characters of this film, like I feel she's given a lot more depth than the average female protagonist in a film like this.
Honestly. Yeah, especially for the time, man.
Right.
Because, like, yeah, at that time, all these, like, because it was a teen movie, like you say, you know, but usually it's, like, about a guy, and there's, you know, like, a bunch of girls and stuff, and they're out partying and stuff, like, that's, that was, at the time, you know, like, you think your road trips and your Euro trips and things like that, yeah.
No, and you're, and that's exactly what I have written here, too, is that, like, of the time, a lot of these comedies would, at the very least, like, in real life, be, like, a noteworthy news story or felonious sexual assault, right? Like, while there are some compromising things, maybe, or some questionable things here, we're going to kind of get into that in a moment. But, so really quick, this is Jill Junger's directorial debut and perhaps their most notable work. It even got a TV reboot in 2009 that ran for about 20 episodes, right?
Really? Yeah. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Well, no, you know what? I think I did watch that.
Really?
Yeah, we might
have. Was it good?
If I don't remember it much, so I doubt it.
Say, I know Larry Brewer comes back,
yeah,
right? So, the dad, to for those who don't know. So, before we spoil or summarize or really discuss any of the events of this film, right, I want to take a point to say that while there may be some things that people have contentions with or find to be problematic within this work, Shakespeare's original one may be of greater concern. While following the larger narrative structure, the original finds our two suitors of the younger sister hiring Petruchio in the original, right, who subsequently breaks Catherine, but Cat in our story, right, her spirit by depriving her of food, demeaning and contradicting and humbling her, even to the point by the end that Catherine proclaims how her subservientness is a calling. Someone could easily view this play as a pro-patriarchal work, or at the very least, a misogynist manifesto, right? Like,
man, yeah, jeez.
But while a comedy and thus presumed to be satire or farce, Taming of the Shrew is one of the most controversial works of Shakespeare's, and like, you know, a point for people to discuss. Now, me myself, I do believe that it is supposed to be this big lambastic statement on gender roles and not necessarily like, this is the way a marriage is supposed to be, guys. Like,
yeah,
especially from Shakespeare as an artist and a person, I don't think that's really what it's about.
Well, a lot of his stuff was like, not I wouldn't necessarily say satire, but it was like,
it spoke on the events of the day, yeah, almost, right?
Exactly. Like, he was almost a comedian in a sense.
You know? This is a comedy. This is
exactly, yeah.
Taming of the Shrew is considered a comedy. Take into mind all the psychological abuse and things I just said to you again. This is a comedy, right? The play itself is a comedy. So, obviously, it is meant to be satirical or a level of farce, right? But, like, to what end, some people have debated. But over that period of time, right, from, like, 1692 forward, this story has gone over a litany of reinterpretations, reimaginings, and retellings to make them palatable for their given audience at that time. I will say this, though, like we said a moment ago, the mid to late 90s was indeed a time to revisit Shakespeare's works. From films like 2001's O, which also starred Julia Stiles.
Oh!
Yeah, as in Othello, but right, the adaptation of
Othello. Oh, okay.
okay. Do you remember the movie?
No.
Mekhi Phifer, Julia Stiles, Josh
Hartnett. Really? No.
We're going to cover it.
Okay.
Because this is a reoccurring segment that we're introducing today about the modern interpretation.
Are we going to do all of
them? Not all of them, but we are going to dedicate a segment going forward, reoccurring, about modern interpretations of, or reimaginings, whatever have you, right, of Shakespeare's work. And some of them we're going to list off right now. So 1996 is Romeo plus Juliet, right? And even Hamlet having three different adaptations done within a decade, right? 1990 with Mel Gibson, Ethan Hawke's in 2000, and in between, 1996's Hamlet, right? So, like...
And Weiss, because you know, with...
Hamlet, 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 Hamlet,
Hamlet, Hamlet, Hamlet, Hamlet, knife, gosh. Now you have up.
He's hitting my butt. Anyway. God.
I'm sorry.
No, it was funny. As soon as you said it, though, it's like, now we have to do this. But anyway, so all these films were coming out among a countless different number of films that were different interpretations, reiterations, or whatever may have you, of Shakespeare's original work, right? But in this film, we are following high school students. A perfect backdrop for any drama or comedy. And thus, I feel that those elements, like, kind of take away not only from our suspension of disbelief as watching a program, right? But, like, also kind of our judgment, right? Like, we've all done stupid things while being young and in love, right?
That's probably why they do that. I never even thought of that. You're right.
Yeah, to a certain extent, I feel that it makes it more
apt. Yeah, but there's other reasons too. But yeah,
the drastic, sure. Exactly, the drasticness of why you would get to these decisions make a lot more sense when you're like, you have a malformed teenage mind, you know, because like, it's kind of questionable how your suitor or your love interest at that point, like, pays somebody to date somebody else and it's supposed to be ethically all right with you. But
was that? Oh, man, I gotta watch this movie.
That is the principle of this film. We're gonna get into this.
Yes.
So finally, I would say one of the biggest underpinnings of this film is about the social climate of sex and, like, obviously, in particular, teenage sex and pregnancy. The father in this film, while, you know, a large comedic relief in Larry Miller, he's an OBGYN who's, like, overly obsessed and worried about teenage pregnancy. And if you were to Ben... adjacent to teenage life and listening to the news at this time, the teenage pregnancy rate was always a point of concern or mention in the average day-to-day existence of the mid to the late 90s, I feel, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So while their dad is kind of overbearing it, but meaning well, he decides to make this rule that his daughters, Bianca nor Kat, date until they graduate. Kat about to graduate at the end of the year, Bianca sophomore in high school. But now Bianca, the one who's kind of chaste and, you know, a little bit, I don't want to say the word domesticated, but you know what I mean? She's seemingly the more socially palatable,
prim and proper.
Thank you. The more prim and proper, clear cut. And instead, she can only date if her sister Kat can date. Now Kat is the shrew, right? A woman who's opinionated, maybe a little bit overly mature or uptight. I guess you could say, like, militantly feminist, right? So it's here that I want to make a few points. Number one, this screenplay is written by two women, okay? And like I said just a moment ago, you know, Kat has these features of being a little bit more uptight and holding herself above, like, the regular teenage societal rigmarole and things like that. But the next point I want to make is that those characteristics are not really dulled by the end of this film, and they're not really presented as being overtly negative, right? In fact, they're perhaps what change our versions of Percutio, in this case, Ledger's Patrick, to, like, again, not even change, I would say, because I give this film a lot of credit that men aren't even held to, like, the lowest common denominator standard and stereotype. While Heath Ledger is supposed to be the high school heart, you learn over time that, like, he doesn't necessarily fit that role.
He's a soft boy.
Well,
he's a soft boy.
He is a pretty boy. That's what you're talking about. You're trying to say I'm not pretty. Are you trying to say I'm not pretty? Because, right. Yeah. And you're right. And I feel like that is a very good statement, too, where they're like, well, you know, she doesn't like guys who smoke. She doesn't, you know, she likes pretty guys. Well, I'm not pretty. You know, like, well, that's to hear this guy say, you know, the first 2 minutes you meet him in the film. But you do shortly learn within the film that, like, this guy isn't really the, you know, ex-con, sold his liver for some speakers stereotype that he's portrayed early on in this film, right? And with that, while the discussion and debate can happen over the events and the ideas within this film, because you have Cameron, who sees Bianca, is instantly smitten with her, and tries to find a way to get around this, meets Ledger, and decides that's who they can pay to go ahead and have him date, but they don't have any money, so they actually have the rich, vain, vapid kid pay and try to move in on that. Now, I do want to make a point to say that while all of these things, and there are a couple other things that you can make an argument, and perhaps maybe there should be a bit of discussion, but like, this film, in and of itself, tackles predatory sexual advances and objectification of women or others in general in the character of Joey, right? Joey is kind of, you know, the vapid, vain, rich, self-interested character. So while being manipulated by Cameron to pay Heath Ledger, Patrick, to date Kat, you know, he is actually kind of being pursued by Bianca. And we'll get into that in a moment, because by the end, though, it's revealed he's just trying to get into her pants and a complete, you know, kind of self-interested jerk. And then she ends up breaking his nose. And I really love that part of the film. But I also want to make the point to say that perhaps one of the more overlooked aspects of this film that we kind of resolve earlier on than that grand finale is, you know, originally Bianca is not just the more chosen of the two sisters. She's given agency in her decision. You see her make and realize the mistake of pursuing Joey through Cameron's efforts, right? And when he kind of confronts her with it, she starts to go with him. This makes Joey mad, and Joey then splits up Kat and Patrick at the prom by telling him, you know, the whole plot to the film, like I am right now. right. But I will say that, like, even in that moment where she gets that revenge on Joey for what he had done to Kat, what he was attempting to do to her, and, you know, she's given the capability to fend for herself, and not a lot of films at this point, or maybe even today, some could argue, do that. But yet they do it with this character.
Yeah, no, like, it's, man, the way you just laid that out, it's crazy to think that it's a Shakespeare play, because, like, it really, it really.
Well, and mind you, this is this also the way that this Shakespeare play has kind of came to the zeitgeist over centuries of retellings and reimaginings and things like that as well, right? Like, this is a modern interpretation. But the last point that I want to make about this is, ultimately, I think one of the greatest aspects of this film is not only is it a good date movie, or a look at films of that time or of that genre, or even the careers that were built off of this point as a foundation, right?
Yeah.
I think it's a snapshot at which point romantic interest in films really started to become more of a complement to one another, focusing not on changing or accepting them, but growing with them as individuals, both becoming more than surface level observations, typical traits, or a befitting archetype, but feeling more closely similar to real couples.
That's very true.
Yeah. I really do. I mean, I don't want to say that, like, this film came and thus films changed. But I think this is a really good example of the point in time in which those changes were being made, if not directly with this film, right?
Does it pass the, man, I don't even remember the name of the test. The test where two women talk about not a male character.
Oh, man, I don't know. That I would think that it does, though. But I don't want to say
it's a certain, like, no. And like, really, if you think about it, there's a lot of movies that don't, and like a ton of movies. It's crazy. But
it's true. Yeah, that is a good barometer for all female characterization, right? Is a woman, and even as a point of contention with this film, is a woman narratively in your story because she fills the role of a romantic
interest? Exactly. Like, is she only there because of... Exactly.
Is that solely her reasoning?
Yeah. Right. And it, like, it's changed like that. Like, nowadays, I think it's getting a lot better. But, man, like, when you look back at a lot of older movies...
Even in an empowering one like this may not pass that...
Yeah, we had to think. We're like, maybe not. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing, you know, I mean, if we're talking about medical advances, we're going a little farther back, you know, but...
Are we going back to the 1600s like we did with...
Not the 1600s, the late 1700s and mostly the 1800s, though, is when this crazy pseudoscience was popular.
I was going to say, but there's a lot of cockamamie
books
in here, right?
It is related to some stuff, which we'll get into at the end, like... How it kind of did lead to some things, not like directly, but you know, it started, you know, it was little pieces, right? We stand on the shoulder of giants, right?
Okay,
not saying these were giants, but
as Bob Ross would say, happy little accidents.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. So, yes, phrenology, let's get into it. So, phrenology, to define it, is a pseudoscience that used measurements of bumps and the shape of the skull to predict mental traits. It was believed that because the brain was an organ and that there were certain localized areas of the brain that they would perform specific functions. And, I mean, that's actually true, though, if you think about it, like...
Right, I was going to say, so they know about the cerebellum and things like that, right? Or, like, at least conceptually what that entails.
No, they didn't. That, like, actually, that's the whole thing, is they didn't, like, they just thought, like, they were, like... mapping the entire brain, like this one gives you this trait, this part gives you that trait, like not like this part makes you breathe, this part makes you think, this part makes you, you know, like,
right. But that's like, they know that there are dedicated, not pathways, but sectors of the
brain. Sections. Yeah. From dissections and stuff, okay. For sure. Yeah. This is the whole thing. Cause like they would like measure brains, like dissect skulls and brains, but also like measure you while you're living, you know, they like measure the distance between different parts of your brain or look for bumps. Like the bumps were the big thing, because if you had bumps, you know, that means that they thought that like the brain was like a muscle, right? And they thought that the more you used it, it would get bigger, so that like that part they
attribute, like somebody's just gonna have a ripped skull. Hey, what's up, guys? I just read the dictionary last week.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I keep laughing because I laughed.
It's stupid, that's why.
it's really funny, and like, but at the time they didn't know, man. They were like, this was the beginning of like the scientific method and stuff. This took
is
place
this
yes
humor-esque time or things like that. What are
it was just a little bit after that, right? So like I said, you know, like the 1800s, like when we were starting, this was like when, you know, really the scientific method was starting to be developed, and like when people really started like doing experiments, you know, there wasn't experimentation. There was, but it wasn't like tracked, you know, it wasn't done like empirically, I guess. Right. But, and speaking of empirical, there is empirical evidence that shows, like, you know, anybody that, because some people might, I don't think, maybe believe specifically in this, you know, but there's evidence. I actually read like a scientific study. You know, I like to go through and like read actual papers when I try to do this research. And it was like one from 2009. And, you know, they like definitively proved that there was no evidence of any of these traits being associated with any parts of the brain. But I mean, by now it's obvious, but still they wanted to. It was just, you know, kind of a cool study.
Right. Yeah. The ultimate note, right? Like, and boom.
So. Phrenology, like as a study, I guess, was invented in 1796 by a German physician named Franz Joseph Gall. And man, the gall of this guy, that's what I really got to say,
right.
Like what I said before. And it really became influential, though, around like 1810 to 1840. And not so much him. I like, obviously, like he had influence to it, you know, like he spread it. But it was a couple other people that really spread it more than him. And one of them was a partner of his that they ended up having a falling out later on. But at the time, a partner of his named Johann Spurzheim, I think that's how you say it.
Okay.
He went around to like the UK and eventually the US like later in life. But the UK in the 18 teens and started spreading the word of it, right? Like started spreading this idea, I guess, because it never really gained traction with mainstream media. You know, whatever was like this.
Is this considered a theory, though? Like, yeah, even if it's discredited and everything else, this is a theory.
I guess. Not really. A hypothesis. Okay. We'll put it as that. Because it's no. I mean, if you want to be scientific with it, it's not a theory. Yeah.
Thank you. And okay. And that's why I said that, though, is like, is there enough that while we would never accept it like we do the theory of gravity... Yeah. It is a theory nonetheless, and no, it is not.
Well, no, because, okay, like, if you wanted, like, the theory of gravity, because in a scientific term, a theory is, like, a set. It's almost like a rule or a law. It's the...
Right. But, we have found these things to be a consistent function of X.
Yes. It's, like, it's a thing that's been tested many times and proven to be, to the best of our knowledge, true. It hasn't been falsified yet, I guess, is the best way to put it.
There you go. Yes,
exactly. Yeah. A hypothesis is really... what a lot of, when we use theory in common terms, that's really a hypothesis, you know? Well, yes, is, exactly. Right. Yeah. Speaking of common terms, this like idea was popular in like the masses, you know, like it may not have been picked up so much by like the scientists and people in the scientific community, but it was picked up.
John Q. Public bought that.
Exactly. It was kind of like horoscopes, right? Like, you know, they like picked up like, oh yeah, you know, let's measure each other's heads and see like, what, you know, because it made him feel like they were like sophisticated to know this, you know, this new breaking science that they thought was real, right?
Well, and I think it's easy, like we say a lot of times, to kind of pick on the past from our position here. We have a lot of scientific...
Exactly.
Like shorthand knowledge that they didn't.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, also, it was really easy to be used with racism too. So in America, they love that, right?
Cha-ching!
Yeah. So anyways, Gall, though, he proposed these principles for phrenology. That the brain is an organ of the mind, which that is right. You know, I would agree with him on that.
Right. Check. Yeah.
Also, that the brain is not a homogeneous unit, but an aggregate of mental organs that have specific functions. So, I mean...
Check.
Well, check and yes, because it is one organ, but it's not... They do have specific functions. It's right. Hard. Yeah. It's not an aggregate of mental organs.
It has subsects, although it is one. Right. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
I guess there is, because there's different glands and stuff. But it is. Yeah. I mean, this one's like a half check. We'll give him a half check on this one. Right.
Check minus.
Yes. The next one is that the cerebral organs are topographically localized, meaning that, you know, the cerebral, like the thinking parts of
the
your brain.
The frontal lobe or whatever.
Well, yeah. Well, what we know now is the frontal lobe. Okay. But where like the higher knowledge, the higher thinking that makes us human, right? Mm-hmm. Those things are topographically, meaning on the top. Like on the outside, mm-hmm. localized in different parts of, you know, or more like it maps. You can map it, localize it in different parts of the brain. So
check.
Another quarter minus? Check or a quarter check. Let's give it a quarter check on that one. Because yes, okay. The frontal lobe, right?
Check so, minus minus. Yes.
Like, this is what I mean. Like some of these things have been like, it's the beginning of some things, you know, but it's not at the same time.
Right.
So this next one. Other things being equal, the relative size of any particular mental organ is indicative of the power or strength of that organ. Now, this one is definitely minus. Or, well, actually, maybe an eighth check. So, other things being equal, I guess, you know, in the brain, like, you
all
know.
All in all.
Yeah, like, not development-wise, right? The relative size of that part of the brain is an indication of how powerful or strong that part of the brain is. So,
yeah, right.
Yes and no, because, all right, we do, and this is, and actually it's not a settled science yet.
Right.
Sometimes archaeologists use the skulls and the shape of skulls to determine, like, well, this one had a bigger frontal lobe, this one had a bigger cerebellum, to understand, like, how animals, different extinct species, like, you know, were.
Could have functioned versus the common counterparts of today.
Yes, could have. Exactly. And you can, and in a sense, extrapolate a little bit of information from right. that. But not how they were. Because, again, we have to separate. Like, they did not understand that, you know, the frontal lobe was where like a lot of the thinking was, and the cerebellum was where like a lot of like the basal functions were, you know, and things like
that. It's like a jigsaw puzzle with a few key missing pieces, right? Like, yes, you can kind of see an out of focus picture, but to say that it is an accurate representation is inaccurate, right?
Exactly. Yes. And he believed, though, so like I keep talking about these sections, right? He called them mental faculties. And he believed that each represented different, you know, faculties. Each of these areas represented different ones. And there was like different sub areas too. Like, this is the thing. Like, they never really agreed. Nobody agreed on where these areas were, how many they were. Like, it was just ridiculous the whole time. Right, but it was so funny. And we were talking about this, and Phineas Gage, you know, this is why I wanted to bring this up, because like his doctor, remember, was a phrenologist.
Right.
He was like, yeah. So he was like, oh, you know, it damaged this part of his brain and stuff, which he should have seen. But yeah, because Spurzheim, and then later this guy named Combe, George Combe, he started helping Spurzheim promote this, right? He was the one that really went to America and got it big. And they, like, further elaborated on it. Because at first, like, Gall had, like, different spaces. He left, like, different areas of the brain where just like, ah, I don't know what that is. Yeah.
But in Gall's original hypothesis, there is not much inklings towards racism, or is there?
No, he didn't. Okay. I don't think he himself, I mean, he might have. I didn't look. I didn't see anything specific. Like, I didn't look up his biography.
But nothing in the work is specifically.
Yeah, not specifically, but people use that.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, especially, what we're about to get into some of the reasons why, because this one was hard for me to find, like, a good, like, list of them, because, they, like, certain spots, like, Britannica didn't really list them at all. They just, like, listed, like, such as blah, 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 you know? And then, you know, I obviously went to Wikipedia, and they, like, listed them in weird ways. The scientific study had the best lists, I think, and they explained why and, like, different, like, traits. Like, this is why scientific studies are the bomb. This is why you go to the source, right? Because of like this, right?
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's a perfect example. Like, the ones they listed were this. And there's, I think, like 26 of them. And I'm going to go through a lot of them quickly. But amativeness, which is like the impulse to propagate, you know, how much you want to.
Right. Okay.
Philoprogenitiveness, which is how like tender you are towards your offspring. So how good you are towards your babies, right?
Okay. Okay.
And like, so these are things like, yeah, you can use those as like traits, but it's not, you know, it's not mapped on your brain.
There's no definitive lobe in the brain for that. Right.
Exactly. Yep. Adhesiveness, which they define as like friendly attachment, you know, like how friendly you are.
How personable you are. Right. Yeah. Okay.
Combativeness, which, you know, combativeness, how combative you are. Destructiveness, how destructive you are. How cunning.
Self-explanatory. Right.
Acquisitiveness, how, you know,
right,
how,
again, you know, self-explanatory. Yep, exactly, right.
Yes. Self-esteem, self-explanatory.
Right.
Love of approbation, which is like ambition or vanity, you know.
Oh,
like,
okay. Okay.
Cautiousness, eventuality, and individuality. So that was an and. And I was like, okay, individuality, right? That's cool. You know, independentness, right? But no, they said it was more aptness to receive an education. So, like, that's what they defined it as, I guess. Yeah.
Okay.
But, yeah. Locality, which, you know, like, how much you are, like, staying local.
Aware
yeah.
of your immediate surroundings you are?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, yes. Words, which, and this is, like, words and verbal memory. And then language. So, like, those language, which they grouped as, you know, language as in speaking and understanding, too. You know, this was one area of the brain, which was important. We'll get into that in a second. And then coloring, which is, like, your disposition for color or your delighting in colors. And, like, this is where, like, oh, you know, an artist has, you know, their coloring muscle is strong, you know, in their brain.
Right, yeah, exactly.
That's what they would say. But, yeah. Or tune, which is like your musical talent, right? Or numbers, which would be mathematics or being a mathematician.
It's like the force.
It's so, that's what I'm saying.
Right. Oh, your midichlorian rates are so high, Anakin. It's crazy.
That's what I'm saying. It reminds me of tarot cards or horoscopes or some like that. It really does, yeah. And then there's constructiveness, comparison, which I didn't look that up, but like I think how much you compare to others or something. Causality, and then mirthfulness, which is like a sense of inference. So like, you know, intuition, you know. And then ideality, which is like your poetic talent. And then benevolence is like a moral sense. But yeah, so like, I mean, like I said, some of these really are kind of, yes, traits you would see, because they are traits you would see, but they're not related to parts of your brain. And so some of these people, like I said, use this to kind of explain racism. Like one of them thought that Australian Aboriginals...
To justify it. Yes,
exactly. To justify it, right. Should I say, or not? Well, both. To explain and justify.
That is true. Right. Yeah, exactly. But
yeah, like they wanted to be like, well, this is why we're superior, and then also be like, that's why we need to be superior.
Right, yeah, not only do I believe it, I have this bullshit evidence of it.
Exactly, yep, exactly. This one guy said that the Australian Aboriginals had underdeveloped cerebral organs, which they don't. And that was the reason why they didn't produce good art, which, I don't know, I love Aboriginal art. It's like really, like, I don't know, it's tribal type. Yeah. Like, that's the coolest, like, the tattoos and all that. Like, yeah,
exactly.
Like, oh, yeah. Different. It's not European art, so it's different. Tons of people, though, also try to compare the skulls of African Americans and European Americans and try to say, like, you know, there's levels to this man, you know, like, we're the top, and that's why black people should be subordinate to us, because look at their skull shape compared to ours, which... There's, like, very little difference in skull shape, if any, you know?
Right, but it could be anything, you know what I mean? Right.
Exactly. If I'm not mistaken, there's more variation between, like, Europeans than there is between Africans. Or, well, sorry, there's, like, an insane amount of variance between Africans.
Like, Western and Eastern.
Yeah, but, like, it's not, like, less. There's more, I guess. There's more difference, like... So it's
right. Opposite. Yeah, I can see that, though.
Yeah, it's the opposite. Like, because we're part Neanderthal, man, because we left at a certain time. And then after that, our gene pool was smaller, right? Like the African gene pool, that's where we originated from. When, you know, people left Africa, that was a bottleneck, right? Because after that,
right.
The ones that stayed, there was more diversity there, because right. That's how, you know, genes work, which we're going to talk about evolution here soon. Not this episode, but, you know, to come.
In general, right.
Yes. And because of that, there's more diversity in Africa than there is in Europe and Asia and America. And
even
that.
As a continent, it's like twice the size, so why wouldn't there be, right?
Exactly. Like, I don't know. Africa is a freaking amazing continent. It is. Yeah. That's another thing. Is Africa's huge, like you said.
It just goes to show that when you think about this for 20 minutes, it just doesn't make any sense, right? Like, oh,
exactly.
Africa, there's no way. Actually, there's a total way, because if you were to go to north, south, east, west, all four of them would be vastly different versus, like,
so
countries
different.
That are size of the states, bro.
Yeah.
No offense to our European listeners at all, but that's just the truth. Agreed. Like, there are states that are the size of countries in Europe.
Yeah, no doubt. They also used phrenology to justify sexism. Surprise.
Wow, what a reach.
Yeah, okay, so what they said, they claimed that women that had larger heads in the back and lower foreheads were underdeveloped, but underdeveloped in the sense for arts and sciences, better for children and religion.
Domestication.
Exactly. Yep. So they also use that as a justification for banning women from politics, because this is something that blows my mind.
Oh, great. Yeah.
And even, I'm sorry, I'm going on a lot of tangents.
No, like, you're right.
But like, even like the beginning of America, not everybody could vote. It's like not even all men could vote. And then eventually that changed in the 1800s pretty quickly to where all white men could vote. Then it was all black men. And then finally, in the 1900s, I think the 1920s, I think it was, women could vote. In the 1920s, right. Man. Yeah, that's insane.
It is, but unfortunately, it bore out over time with things like this.
Yeah.
Everybody will find an excuse to not look at somebody as an equal, to not give somebody their just due,
mm-hmm.
And they'll even come up with a way to justify why.
Exactly, yeah. Now, like I said, phrenology kind of did help in some senses. And one of these ways I would say it somewhat helped, at least for the time, was in criminology. Because at the time, you know, criminals were just thrown into, like, you know, a pit, essentially. Like, especially in crazy people, too, you know. But they kind of, they started thinking, like, oh, we could diagnose criminals and maybe there's a reason why, or maybe we could change them if we were able to work out these parts of the brain, you know, to help them not have these moral, you know, misgivings or whatnot.
right.
Yeah. So some they, like, deemed too intellectually disabled, right? They're like, oh, you know, their brains, their skulls are too messed up. So they just need to work and house them together. And a lot of those people, like, were there forever, you know, and, like, insane houses.
Just,
like,
I was condemned to work. They were put to, like, asylums and not prisons is the difference. Right?
Yes, yes. Yeah, which were still weren't that great at the time.
No. They were ramshackle shows.
Exactly, yeah. But the criminals that they deemed, like, intelligent and that, like, had, like, vicious intent, like, they were confined and isolated and, like...
So they're crafty. Yeah. You need to be...
Yes.
Oh my God.
Those guys, they thought a lot of them could be like reformed, right? That's the thing.
But you would make them go insane doing that.
Well,
wouldn't you?
It depends on what, like, I mean, whatever this phrenologist thought or believed, you know, because like I said, there's all these different, like, it was just crazy. Like, cause man, it really, there was some deep rabbit holes you could go in with this stupid stuff. Like,
yeah. There's no uniform thing here. There's no checklist to say, okay, by phrenology standards, this guy is deemed redeemed or whatever you want to say. No, it's just.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, perfect example of this. So there was one, and all it said was a reference was one person with homicidal intent. So I don't know if he like killed somebody or like just wanted to kill somebody.
Conspiracy or attempt.
Or something. Yeah. But they told him to become a butcher instead because then you get him work with meat, and, you know? And
you can cleave a lot of stuff if you're a butcher.
Yeah. And then another person with the same type of whatever diagnosis, I guess, they told them to become a military chaplain so they could watch people die.
Oh, man.
You know, like when they get put to death. And that worked for them, too, I guess.
You know what, though? That is true. You know what? It work with the best of somebody.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they take their aptitude test. Like, oh, yep. You like killing things. All right, well, we'll send you over to do this.
Well, we got a cattle farm right on down the road. We can kill the out of some shit, bro.
Exactly. Oh, man. And, like, I mean, like I said, though, like, insane asylums. So this is the one where it kind of did help because, like, insane asylums at the time were really, really bad. It was probably even worse in the 1800s than the 1900s. It was bad at the time, you know. There was this one physician, though, named John Connolly that, like, wanted to, like, diagnose patients with it. And through that, he, like, got leniency on a lot of patients that were clearly mentally disabled. You know, like, that probably did something wrong.
So the distinction here are people who are criminally insane versus actually just not able to fit in functioning society regularly.
Exactly. Right? Okay. Like, I, yeah. Like,
but I just want to make clear your distinction, too, right? You know?
But, like, yeah. Right. So, like, these are people that maybe, like, maybe had a violent outbreak or something that... were like schizophrenic people with a violent outbreak or something like that.
If you could acclimate them or regiment them, they could probably
put them in a home versus that's a prison. Yes. You know, and like he helped a lot of people, I would say, with that. You know, and I didn't look into him deeply, so maybe he has some other By the 1840s, it really started like being discredited. And two of the main studies that discredited it was done by first Jean-Pierre Florence, who performed experiments on pigeons where he destroyed different parts of their brains and realized, oh yeah, I mean, it does, like, hey, this pigeon can't, you know, walk anymore, this pigeon can't fly anymore, or this pigeon can't breathe anymore, or things like that. It showed that, like, no, it didn't fit with the way Gall and all these other phrenologists were talking about.
Right. It counterdicts enough to show that they had some bearings in reality, but not enough to have a foothold in it, right?
Exactly. And the one that really did, though, was done by a French physician named Paul Braca. And he discovered an area in the frontal lobe, which is later to be named Braca's area, that controls language production. And he discovered that through autopsies and, like, you know, people that maybe were born with it damaged or damaged through life, found out that that damage to the left side of your frontal lobe reduced or damaged their ability to speak, but not their ability to understand language. And that was one big thing, like I said earlier, that, you know, language was a specific area where it was like, you know, all of it, you know, speak it, understand it, all that. And that, like, from there, people were like, you know, this phrenology thing is stupid. They're, you know, like, I mean, at the time, that's what really...
This kind of just seems like an excuse for people to be racist sometimes.
Exactly. So, yeah. So, after, like, I mean, it kind of just fell out of favor after that, you know. But, like I said, there's, like, neuropsychology, psychiatry, even archaeology. These things were influenced by phrenology. Even though it's this dumb, like, goofy, quacky pseudoscience, it still has its basis. They didn't stand on the shoulders of giants this time. Maybe like a, you know, a smaller or normal sized person.
Right.
But we still stood on the shoulders of that person, that gall, that had the gall, the guy that had the gall to say our brains were mapped like that.
Well, you know, and I kind of feel bad, but, you know, maybe he didn't have as much gall as we thought. If this guy honestly was just thinking he was onto something and his got co-opted, I feel bad for him. But we don't know that for certain, right? You know what I mean? And unfortunately,
yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, yeah.
Phrenology has left a bad taste in people's mouth, and rightfully so. But like you just said, like, we did reach over those efforts, those misunderstandings, those perhaps misgivings that people have of people, and we've learned better from
it. Agreed, man. That's a great way of putting it, too, for sure.
Ever the optimist. And with that, we're optimistic that you enjoyed this episode and will ones further. Give us a rate and review on your podcast platform of choice. Find us on our social medias, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and on Patreon. For Brad, I'm Kyle, and we will see you again here soon.
I shalt see thou.
Blamitiest of the Blams.
Ah, brain soda.